Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Roma Agrawal. She's a structural engineer, and she builds big. She builds bridges, train stations, skyscrapers, and she's written a book. We'll be talking about this new book, Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures. Roma, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this book answers an important question, and I'm embarrassed to say that I wasn't quite sure what this is. What do structural engineers do?
Well, you would not be the only one, to be honest, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. So in really short, structural engineers are responsible for making sure that buildings and bridges stand up.
That sounds like an awesome responsibility.
Yes, it is. And I think that's what's so interesting about our profession is that you don't hear about us when things are going right, because when things are going right, you know, our houses, our buildings, our bridges, they're just standing there, they're doing their thing, they're quiet, you know, everything's normal. And then you hear about us when something goes badly, you know, if something collapses or something goes wrong, then suddenly you start hearing, oh, structural engineers, I wonder what happened there.
What encouraged you to write a book? Because trust me, there's been a lot of structural engineers through the centuries, and not many of them have written a book for the general public. And I want to say this to the audience. This is a really interesting, it's a fun book, it's fascinating. I get to learn things about why I sing London Bridge is Falling Down. I even learned how you met your husband. It was bizarre.
Spoiler alert.
And it's got your own drawings in it. So what encouraged you to finally write something for the general public?
So I've been doing my job as a kind of normal structural engineer for a number of years. I think it must have been sort of 4 or 5 or 6 years. And then I was really fortunate to work on the team that designed the Shard in London, which is the tallest tower in Western Europe. So it's probably pretty average by Manhattan standards, but for us in Europe, it's pretty tall. And I found that people were really fascinated by the project. And when I went out and started talking to people, you know, started with engineers, but then expanded to university students and then actually to children and to families, I found that they were absolutely fascinated about what it is we do.
Go ahead.
So I was going to say that you know, there's only so many people I can physically go out and see and speak to, and I thought that the book would be a fantastic way to try and reach, you know, a much bigger global audience, and so Built was born.
Now, the book itself is interesting because it starts out talking about the different forces, the different physical forces that a structural engineer has to consider, and then you talk about materials and concerns, and it literally is a basic introduction to structural engineering, like the reader, before they know it, is starting to use architectural terms.
I'm glad to hear that. But what was actually even more important to me than, you know, explaining the kind of the maths and the physics about structural engineering is the stories, because I think there were two really good stories I wanted to tell. One was the stories of structures, because they don't just appear one day and they're built. You know, they go through highs and lows and failures and successes, and you know, there's a whole narrative around that. But then also the human beings, you know, the people, the actual engineers themselves, who, as you found out, are often quite eccentric characters.
Well, we're going to talk about one example from the book, just one. One of the weird things that I learned at the beginning of this chapter is that you've been known to stroke concrete.
Yes.
Okay. You need to elaborate on that.
Well, concrete is this amazing material which starts off as rock. You then fire it, you burn it, you mix it up with other stuff. It turns into a liquid, and then you pour it into molds and it becomes a solid rock again. But what's really cool about it is that, you know, you can create so many different types of textures, different looks, different feels, all sorts of stuff. It's a very versatile material. And so, yeah, you know, when I see different textures of concrete that I haven't seen before, I want to kind of go and feel it and see what it's like.
Did you use concrete in the Shard?
We did. And the entire foundation, the basement, is made of concrete. And then we used it to create the central stability system for the Shard as well, which is its spine, which keeps it stable against wind forces. And there's quite a few columns and some of the floors as well that are made from concrete. And the statistic is insane. So after water, concrete is the most used material on our planet.
Well, let's talk about a specific structure that you talk about. And I have to say, domes have always fascinated me about how they get built, because I was never quite clear about how that happened and never researched it. And the building you talk about is the Pantheon, which is in Rome. When was the Pantheon built?
So it was built about 2,000 years ago. And the timescales just boggle the mind, because you go in there today and it's pristine. It's lovely. It's peaceful. The structure looks pretty new. And then to think that it's actually 2,000 year old, I mean, I can't even compute that in some ways. And and also still holds the record for being the largest unreinforced concrete dome in the world 2,000 years later, which is absolutely incredible.
So this gets to the point. How did the Romans do it? Now, what was the ancient cement? How was it made?
So they created, the kind of modern equivalent of the concrete that we are very used to today, where they found some ash which existed next to one of the volcanoes in Italy.
Is this the Pozzolana? I want to use this word because it's a great word, and there are many great words in your book. Pozzolana?
Pozzolana, exactly. And I'm sure we're pronouncing it awfully, and somebody from Italy will have to tell us how to say it properly. The pozzolanic ash, which they mixed with burnt lime and created this kind of goopy mixture. And then they added bits of broken tile and pieces of rock and mixed it together and then created their concrete. And that's pretty much the way we still make it. And then they used that in all sorts of different structures. So not only did they build beautiful domes, but they used it in their walls, they used it in the foundations of some of the big viaducts that they built and under the huge, well, at the time, 10-story apartment blocks that they created as well.
Now, why are they putting the bits of other rocks and stuff? What does that do for the concrete?
So it gives the concrete a bit more body, because the actual ash or the cement powder that we use today is quite expensive. It's quite difficult to produce. And what it does is that when you mix that with water, it actually binds to other material incredibly well. So by mixing in some broken pieces of tiles as they did, we use what we call aggregate, which are basically graded pieces of stone. We are just trying to reduce the amount of cement powder that we're installing in our concrete, which actually makes it more eco-friendly than if we just used a pure cement paste.
Now, this is where we're going to get a little bit into the physics of what you do. As you write, concrete loves compression, but doesn't react well to tension. Talk to me about the difference between those two things, compression and tension.
So compression is squashing. So, you know, you take, I'm going to use my carrot analogy that I use. So you take a carrot in your hand and you try and bend it. You'll see that the top of the carrot, if you're making a U shape, the top of the carrot is going to get squashed together and the bottom of the carrot is going to get pulled apart. And if you keep kind of bending the carrot, what you'll see is that the bottom eventually splits. But the top is actually fine until that crack kind of basically breaks it apart. And concrete behaves a bit like that. The concrete is great. You squash it down. You put a heavy weight on it, and it absorbs it. So I think I say 80 elephants.
That's right.
Stand on a single brick-shaped piece of concrete, and it would crumble. And you pull it apart, and it only takes about a tenth of that force, and it will crack.
Mm. Now, the Romans are faced with making this enormous dome. And obviously making a dome from concrete is a challenge. How did the Romans do it?
So I don't actually know the exact intricacies of how they created it. But what we can do today when we're creating domes is to basically create that shape. So we might use planks of timber, we might use polystyrene, and we call that formwork. So that's creating the kind of the base shape. And then you can pour the concrete on top of it. And it's pretty likely that's what the Romans did, using, you know, timber, wooden planks of wood. So what was really clever about what they did was, because they knew that concrete is great in compression and domes are largely in compression, They knew that they could achieve quite a large space by producing a dome. And then they made sure that the dome was actually thicker at the base, because that just gave it that extra little bit of stability, where you do get a little bit of subtle tension forces running through the concrete. Because at the time, they hadn't quite invented reinforced concrete, which is what we do today,
right,
where we stop cracking by using steel inside the concrete.
Is that what we call rebar?
Exactly. So reinforcement bars shortened down to rebar.
Right. Now, So people who've never been to Rome, this huge dome, it really is a hemisphere. It's really a half.
It's a hemisphere from the inside. That's right.
Okay. That is amazing. It's absolutely incredible. Now, one of the other things, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, which is, you dated about 5th century AD, you enter what they call, and I love this term, I'm going to use this from now on, the crumbly ages. What happened? Like, people just forgot everything or decided that they were never going to use concrete again? Or what happened?
Again, I guess it's more historically accurately known as the Dark Ages.
Because, the crumbly ages sound so much better.
I agree. I think that the theory was that not a lot of progress happened in the sort of 1,000 years that followed the Roman Empire. And I don't know. I guess as the Roman Empire was defeated, but a lot of the technologies that they used, and concrete, I don't think was the only one, we lost a lot of their kind of intellectual property, as it were. And concrete just wasn't used for a long time. Partly it could be because people didn't want to use it, or because it was lost, or it was just more fashionable to use different technologies like brick, for example.
But then it reemerges in the 1300s. Was there resources written down so people knew how to mix the aggregate and put it together? I mean, were there sources left over from ancient Rome that literally told people in the 1300s, this is how you make concrete?
So this, again, is one of those tricky ones where it could have been a combination of them actually studying ancient Roman ruins that were then, I guess, starting to be looked at, but also maybe just rediscovering it, because the Romans weren't the first to use concrete. They were the first to use it in the way they did. And perhaps, engineers in the 14th century just sort of rediscovered it and started recreating it. But it was only used in quite a small tentative way. But when it really found its own was probably pretty much in the modern era, the last couple of centuries, when we started really building a lot of really large structures, and we wanted them to be quick, and they got bigger, so they needed to be stronger, and brick just wasn't doing the job anymore at that point.
Now, we talked about you using concrete in the shard, but what's amazing to me that you admit to in the book is you really aren't that fond of heights, and yet you work with really tall buildings.
Yeah, I've admitted to a few different things in this book, haven't I? yeah. So the height thing is, I'm also not good in planes. So I have I have this slightly strange relationship with height. And it's really interesting. So it's all about, for me, perception of safety. So I really vividly remember having to walk up some scaffolding stair, which feels quite open. And that was only up to level 5. And I remember my legs kind of turning into jelly. And then I once climbed a ladder right at the top of the tower around level 72. And the glass wasn't up yet. And if anything's going to cure, your kind of debilitating fear of heights, it's that. And I said at the time, I said, you know what? I'm going to hang out here till the lifts are installed. And when that's done, then you let me know and I'll take the lift back down.
I have the same fear of heights. And when I read, read about you working in the shard, it just really sent chills down my spine. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Roma Agrawal, structural engineer who builds big. She builds bridges, train stations, skyscrapers like the Shard. And we're talking about her wonderful new book, Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures. Getting back to the ancient Romans, the Romans were the first people to really build tall, too. And you talked about Roman insulae. What were they what were they like to live in?
So insulae would have been a really strange phenomenon, I guess, for the people of that era, because they were very used to living in, one family dwellings which normally had an open atrium in the middle, so they had some open space. But then I guess, quite similar to the modern era, people suddenly started flocking in and the population really increased. So then you're starting to think, well, how do I fit in so many people into quite a compact space? And so they started building insulae, which means island, and they created entire blocks of these, well, I guess, high-rise apartment buildings, which went up to 10 stories.
When I try to think of a 10-story ancient Roman building, I get the willies. Like, what?
Yeah, and rightly so, because they had loads of trouble. So there was records of cows climbing up them. Some of them were destroyed by fires. We know all about, you know, the number of fires that happened in ancient Rome. And what's really interesting is nowadays we pay a fortune to live up high in the penthouses. Those are the most expensive apartments. But actually, it was the opposite in the Roman insulae because, you know, the last thing you want to do is to buy a really expensive apartment on the top floor and then carry your waste physically up and down 10 flights of stairs.
Now, you have a whole discussion about building tall in this book. And one of the fascinating things is obviously engineers have to solve things as they go along. When you were working on the shard, you did something very strange. You worked in two directions at once. Explain that.
Yeah, so that was a really fun piece of engineering that we did. And the reason we did that was to try and save time on the program. And as you can imagine, time equals money in construction land. So what you would normally do if you're trying to build a deep basement is to dig a big hole in the ground and then put your concrete in, come back up, you put your ground floor slab in, and you know, from above it looks like you've done nothing, but what you have done is all hidden underground. What we did here was to say, well, how do we create some sort of structure, some temporary stilts, which will allow us to build, you know, the bit above ground at the same time as we're still building the basement? So at one point, we had 20 stories of this, you know, this concrete core, the spine of the shard, supported on steel columns, and the foundations weren't quite finished yet. So it was such an amazing experience to be a part of, you know, new pioneering engineering.
I have to ask you, okay, Roma, because when you describe something like that, it just sounds sort of nerve-wracking to a person who doesn't know structural engineering. So obviously you figured this all out in advance. And when you do something that's sort of novel like this, are you sweating the math all the time? Like, did I remember to care, you know, put the decimal point in the right spot? Is the material correct? I mean, it must have been really nerve-wracking.
So, you know, it's really important that we do this even if we're designing things that have been done before. So things are checked a number of times. We check stuff in computer models, in spreadsheets, you know, quick hand calculations. And you'll always find that the engineers that have a lot of experience will be able to look at stuff, and they have this kind of gut instinct about whether things are going to look right.
I don't want to hear gut instinct. I want to know that it's mathematics. I want to know it's done to the decimal point.
Yeah, this is after sort of three rounds of computer checks and so on.
Oh, God.
And the other thing we do is we actually add margins. So we add almost about 50% onto all the loads that we calculate.
Got it.
Say, that's our margin. So we really know that, you know, things are going to be stable.
A lot of people don't realize that when you're building tall, you have to deal with sway, that tall building sway. And that sounds unnerving to an awful lot of people, but they're engineered to deal with sway. In what ways?
Well, so to me, because I'm from the profession, I think it's really obvious that towers sway. But when I mentioned this to somebody who wasn't an engineer, they just kind of looked at me aghast. And I said, okay, I must put that in my book. So just like trees, all buildings move, and the taller you get, the more they move. And it's important to let them move, because the more rigid you make a structure, the more material that goes into it, the more clunky it becomes, the less eco-friendly it is. So it's actually quite normal to make sure that, you know, the buildings are, they're going to sway. So what we're doing is to make sure that we don't feel sick or queasy when we're up there. So there's all these kind of studies done to know what is the acceleration, the kind of the speed of the movement that people can feel And at that point, we try and make sure that our buildings sway underneath that threshold, so you shouldn't be able to feel it.
I think what most people worry about is that people think about the materials we're working with, say concrete and steel, and they don't see those materials as having that much give to allow sway.
Right, but they do actually have give. They just
require
a huge more amount of force than we would be used to in order to do that. And, you know, the amount buildings sway is kind of not a lot. So if you think about the height of a tower and divide that by 500, that's the kind of upper limit that you would expect a tower to move.
And in some cases, buildings are now using exoskeletons to sort of give them extra support, correct?
Yeah, so exoskeletons was a new, you know, idea, a new technology that was proposed by an engineer called Fazlur Khan, who emigrated from Bangladesh to the U.S. And he's, again, an incredible character, precocious young boy, incredibly smart, came to the U.S. and just brought with him his kind of genius. And he basically turned the traditional skyscraper inside out. And by putting the stability system on the outside of the structure, creating this exoskeleton, it basically means that you can build much, much taller with the equivalent amount of material. So the tallest buildings in our world, in the world today, are based on his innovation.
Does that include the Burj Khalifa in Dubai?
It does. So that was a slightly different, that's not quite an exoskeleton. That's more like a bunch of tubes, which is another one of his ideas. So basically that's like a collection of lots and lots of tubes, which are individually exoskeletons that come together to create a kind of a stable bunch of straws. You could try and imagine it that way.
We're in the last couple of minutes of the show, last 5 minutes, and I have to ask you about London Bridges falling down, because I learned what that meant in your book, and I'm so grateful for it. But it was an insane story. The first London Bridge was crazy.
It really was. And, you know, again, this is one of those stories that I just didn't really know about. But I said, come on, there must be a great story behind this if it's got the word bridge in the song. So research showed me that it took decades to build it. It had about 19 arches. It took them over a year to build just one of those arches. The piers of this bridge, you know, were so close together and so large that they almost dammed the river, which really messed up the way the river flowed.
Oh, my God.
There were fires on there.
Well, people were building houses and businesses on the bridge.
And these buildings actually overhung the Thames. So I'll leave it to your imaginations how the toilets worked at that era.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it was a bit of a disaster. But ultimately, it actually served Londoners for over 600 years.
That's a little frightening.
Before we gave up on it.
As you describe it, like when everybody had built everything on the bridge, which in several stories, we're not talking about one-story buildings, right? We're talking about several-story buildings.
Several stories, yeah.
And so what was it, just like a bunch of dark alleyways going across the bridge?
Pretty much. And the irony of the whole situation was that this was the only kind of overground crossing that existed at the time across the river.
Oh my God.
It was meant to make people's lives easier so that they could get from one side of London to the other. But actually what would happen is that it would get so congested that people would be spending hours and hours and hours trying to get across a relatively short distance.
And again, this is in a chapter in the book where you talk about five different bridges. And I have to mention one, that the Canterbury Bridge, the Ishibuni Bridge.
Mm.
What a strange bridge that is. And you went on it. It sounds like it has a lot of give. So when you're in the middle, you're really swaying.
You can make it sway, which is sort of what I did. And then that freaked me out a little bit. But if you imagine the old rope bridges, a lot of the kind of the physics theory behind these sorts of bridges, which are called stress ribbon bridges, is quite similar. And the U.S. actually has quite a few. Now, if you ask me to name one, I'm not going to be able to do that.
Okay, that's okay.
But the U.S. actually has quite a few. I went to the Czech Republic, to Germany, and to Japan. I was actually writing a research paper on these types of bridges. And they just completely fascinated me because what really struck me about these bridges is that it really depended on the culture. So if people were used to their bridges being a little bit, you know, kind of swayy or a little bit wobbly, then that country embraced them. But in the UK, you know, we've got a handful of them. They're not very popular here.
One of the great things I love is how you relate the buildings to other inventions. In the case of skyscrapers, one of the critical things is the invention of the elevator by Ellis Otis. Because he wouldn't have been able to do that without the invention of the wagon spring. Without elevators, we can't build tall because nobody's going to want to walk up 50 stories. Thank God
Absolutely.
For that.
Exactly. And that's probably why the Romans stopped where they did at about 10 stories, because they, you know, people probably just didn't want to climb any more.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine doing that every day? That must get old really fast.
I'm sure it did. It probably made you quite physically fit, but probably not that much fun.
But
So I love that kind of the tracking of, you know, the wagon spring leading to the safety lift with the brake, which Elisha Otis created. And then that basically kind of unlocking the sky to us, you know, just enabling us to actually build much, much taller than we ever even really imagined that we would be able to achieve.
Now, for most skyscrapers that people know about, you take an elevator to a certain height, and then you have to get off, get on another elevator to go up the rest of it. But when you went to the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, you went straight up to the top.
I think I did. It was a long time ago now. So there's a couple of reasons why lifts sometimes need to be kind of broken halfway through your journey. One is where this core that I talked about, the spine of the structure, actually steps in. So the lifts need to kind of, you get off one lift, which is in one bit of the core, and then you come onto a new lift, which is in a different bit of the core. But at some point, this is kind of going beyond the height of the Shard. We're going more into Burj Khalifa territory. The cables, the steel cables that actually hold your lift car up, they get so heavy that you're spending a lot of energy just dragging the cables themselves
Got
up
it.
And down.
Good.
And so at some point, you just need to say, you know what, that's heavy enough. I'm going to start a new lift now.
We're completely out of time. I can't recommend this book enough. We are talking about Roma Agrawals, who's a structural engineer who builds things like bridges, train stations, skyscrapers. And she's written a wonderful book that'll make you look at buildings in a different way. It's called Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures. Roma, thank you so much for writing this book.
Oh, thank you. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.